Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Good evening. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. Well, we've made it through April to National Bike Month, better known as May here in the U.S. Truly, it is the beginning of cycling here in Northeast Ohio, and we can usually depend on good weather. This week, if it's any indication, is that we're going to have a great cycling season. It's just been beautiful here. All the trees are in bloom. So if you have allergies, it's not a good place. But if you don't, it's gorgeous. There will be hundreds, if not thousands, of events this month to celebrate National Bike Month, including the famous two-day double century ride, TOSRV, in Northeast Ohio. It is the Tour of the Scioto River Valley. It's 52 years old this year. As always, it'll be held on Mother's Day weekend, much to the chagrin of mothers and wives of many cyclists in Ohio. We also have national events, including Bike to Work Week, Cyclofemme, and the beginning of the National Bike Challenge. So all in all, it's a boon for cycling on every level here in the U.S. Elsewhere in the world, it's biking as usual. So many countries don't need a special day or week or month, and actually just take the bicycle in stride for everyday transportation, pleasure, and competition. So I mentioned the word competition, and it seems there's a bit of animosity and gnashing of teeth on Team Sky. Chris Froome and Bradley Wiggins are a bit testy as to who will be in the leader's position at this year's tour. I think this is a wait and see, but it seems like they're squaring off, and it should be maybe an interesting tour. After talking to Andy Hampston the other week and knowing what he said about Eddie Merckx saying that cyclists now are boring, maybe it won't be so boring this year. It's unfortunate for Ivan Basso. He was the hopeful that he was going to be the bearer of a pink jersey as the Giro d'Italia winner. The Giro begins today. Basso had to withdraw from competition, and this is really ugly, due to a perineal cyst, which is reportedly, quote, larger than a golf ball. And because it does not contain liquid, it cannot be drained with a syringe, and it is preventing Basso from even getting on a bike. Together with his team doctor and manager, Roberto Amadio, Basso decided Thursday morning to pull himself from the race that he won twice, once in 2006 before serving a doping suspension, and again in 2010 following his suspension. So that's sad. It would have been nice that he could at least compete. One of the most upsetting pieces of news I got this week is the apparent disappearance of $64,000. Of the money that had been donated to the Paul Kimmage Defense Fund last fall. Evidently, the money seems to be in an account belonging to Aaron Brown, who is also known as the UCI Overlord, if you follow any of his Twitter tweets, I guess they call him. Brown works for and with Cyclismus, the popular satire site on cycling that is run by Leslie Cohen. And if this situation isn't reined in and the money isn't accounted for and back in Paul Kimmage's account soon, Cyclismus might come crashing down, which would be too bad. Leslie is not considered to be in on this at all, and she is trying to sort of distance herself from Mr. Brown, as well as separate the Cyclismus work from what he's doing. He moved over to Girona, Spain earlier this year. So that's kind of ugly. I did mention at the end of the show last week that I was so excited that we were going to have Secretary LaHood back on the show. Alas, it was not to be. Our interview was canceled literally at the 11th hour, at 11 o'clock. It was going to be that I was talking to him Monday morning. That was when they were giving me the time, at 11 o'clock on Sunday night. However, his deputy press secretary, Sharon, immediately got back to me with a new date. So he will be with me next weekend. And the good news is I'll be able to ask him about both of the bike safety summits that were held, one in Tampa and one in Minneapolis, and what is in his future now that the president has announced his candidate for the new Secretary of Transportation. This week, I'm pleased to offer up what I hope will be two interesting discussions with two eminently qualified people. Last fall, I spoke with Tim Blumenthal, president of Bikes Belong, and when he told us that a new position had been announced, the Department of Government Relations, in the new BOEM Strategy Center, affectionately dubbed the War Room. Tim also told us that his appointment for that position was Jen Dice. Jen has an amazing background, including a master's degree in public administration from the University of Kansas, work as a lobbyist for city and county governments, press director for both the Colorado State House and Senate, and is part of a team that secured $200 million in federal funding for single-track trails and bike parks. In her spare time, Jen is an endurance athlete and competes annually in events like the Leadville Trail 100. She is also the first woman to hike up and mountain bike down Mount Kilimanjaro, Tanzania. Jen will be with me in a moment. We will also have a conversation with Larry Pizzi. Larry is the president of Curry Technologies and understands the electric bike business better than anyone else I know. As bike sharing, commuting, and more bike-friendly environments expand, e-bikes are becoming a formidable category for the bike shop and a boon to many who might never otherwise ride a bike. So we'll have a little bit of news in between. Let's get right to it and welcome Jen Dice, VP of Government Relations for Bikes Belong, to the Outspoken Cyclist. Jen, thanks for joining me this evening.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
That's good, because we've been trying to kind of hook up for an interview for a while, and things I hope have settled down for you from last fall when it was announced that you were joining Bikes Belong as the VP of Government Relations. And as I remember reading in Brain, it said it was the War Room.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, it's the Leslie Boehm Strategy Center, and I don't know if you knew Leslie Boehm.
Very well. I knew him back in the 70s. I knew him when he started Eclipse.
Wonderful. You know, he was a remarkable man, and he really inspired everyone at Bikes Belong to be more strategic, to be more political, to use technology and data to really drive solutions and to run, you know, some of our bicycling campaigns like political campaigns. And so what we're creating in Boulder is the Leslie Boehm Strategy Center, and it's going to be technology-based and political-based and really getting into sort of some grassroots local bicycling campaigns. So I'm excited to be running it.
And I'm excited that everybody sort of looked at Leslie as that figurehead. You know, I got to interview him, and he told us about his work with using the NRA as an example, and I thought it was a brilliant example at that time. And I did see him at the bike summit last year. So it was very sad. It was very sad that he is now gone. But lots lives on after him. So let's talk about Jen. You have an amazing background. Fill us in a little bit on some of the things you've done, and everything kind of qualifies you for this work that you're going to be doing.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You're being very complimentary. I appreciate that. I'm just lucky to be here. We have a lot of talented people at Bikes Belong and People for Bikes. My background has just been lobbying and public policy work. And really, ever since grad school, I've been in different lobbying roles for city government, county government. I've worked for a couple different legislatures. But the last decade, I've been working with the International Mountain Bicycling Association as their head lobbyist. And I guess when I started at IMBA, we had about 20 people. When I left, we were close to 60. We had just been growing gangbusters, and our work was before Congress, before the federal public land agencies, before the White House, and we did a lot of regional public lands work for access and protecting public lands. And so I've been in the bike industry for about 11 years now, and absolutely love the industry, love the suppliers, the retailers, the advocacy base, both on-road and off. So I'm really, excited or blessed or lucky to be here.
And you love good espresso.
Yeah, of course. People say that I am naturally caffeinated. I drink a lot of coffee.
Well, you also seem to thrive on ultra-distance events, including the Leadville 100, which you do every year. You are also the first woman to hike up and mountain bike down Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. Can you tell us what that was like? I mean, really, when did you do that?
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing experience, and it's really more luck than anything. A good friend of ours is the Goodwill Ambassador to Tanzania. His name is Doug Pitt, and he has this nonprofit called WorldServe, and he has put in about 700 water wells around Tanzania and Kenya. And a couple years ago, he had this idea as a fundraiser, let's hike up and mountain bike, let's get permission from the president of Tanzania to be the first mountain bikers to come down. And so we tested it 2 years ago, And then we actually just got back a couple weeks ago from the second trip. So I've actually done it twice. And in this last trip, we took 18 people that we hiked up, 11 of us mountain biked down, and we raised about $500,000 for fresh water wells.
Wow.
Which will serve about 25,000 people over the course of the next 20 years, or 25,000 people for 20 years. So it's a remarkable charity, and I was lucky to be a part of it.
Okay, how did you get the mountain bikes up there?
Everybody asks that. That's a great question. So we have porters, and the porters are Tanzanian people, and they are the nicest people you've ever met in your life, and they work so hard. And so there's this small village of porters going along with us, carrying tents and food and bikes. And with the altitude of Kilimanjaro is 19,000, I think, 300 feet.
Okay.
And so, embarrassingly, you know, you really, all I could carry was my camelback and, you know, my bike on the way down. So, I mean, it really, it's challenging from an altitude perspective, for sure.
And how long did it actually take to make the descent?
The descent we did over 2 days.
Okay.
Because we hiked up for 4 days, but the fourth day, you start at 11 p.m. and you hike all night long until sunrise. So we crested, we were at the very top of Kilimanjaro at Aruru Peak at about 7 a.m. And we biked down part of the way that day and then the rest on the second day. So 2 days.
And how beautiful was it?
It was stunningly beautiful. There's glaciers at the top. And so biking at 19,000 feet and then ultimately doing a 13,000-foot mountain bike, very technical descent was just incredible. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. I have to give you a lot of credit. But the truth is, it sounds like a lot of fun. And it just sounds like sort of a once-in-a-lifetime thing that you got to do. It's awesome. Is it going to happen again?
We're not sure. Probably not. You know, it was just a really a one time, the president of Tanzania let us test the ride. And then for the real trip, which was just a couple weeks ago. So 11 people got to mountain bike down Tanzania, and it will probably be many, many years before the president approves it again or a group gets organized to go back.
So you can say you did it. That's very cool. Let's get back to the work you're going to be doing with Bikes Belong and your work with government. You say that one of the objectives for your new position is to organize business and industry, and I'll quote you, into a powerful voice to make bicycling better in America. So are we talking about the bicycle business and the bicycle industry, or is there some effort to bring in other types of support?
Well, definitely both. I mean, we've never done a good job of really organizing the bicycle business that's out there.
Retailers, I agree.
Suppliers, racers, events, charity rides. We've never done a good job of organizing the family, and that will definitely be the first focus. So, I mean, I learned yesterday that there's 35,000 people that are employed directly in the bike industry, and we know maybe a few thousand of them. And so I think our first charge is to really circle our wagons, make sure we know where our businesses are located, how many people they employ, what kind of economic impact they have in their local community, and really telling that story of the power of business and industry. But then there's also a bunch of businesses that benefit from cycling and are very supportive of cycling. You know, one that a day doesn't go by at People for Bikes or Bikes Belong that we read an article about a mayor saying he wants, you know, more tech companies to come to his community, and part of that is that he's, you know, putting in bike paths and bike lanes and excited about bike share to make his community more vibrant and more attractive to young urban professionals that want to be located in, you know, amazing cities, and that's kind of a quality of life thing. So we're seeing a lot of tech companies locating on bike paths and bike lanes, having bike share programs, having bike concierge. So we think there's a lot of synergies in the technology communities. And then, of course, there's, of course, tourism, you know, a lot of tourism chambers, retailers benefit from bicycling. And then just really along bike corridors, people stop, they shop, they drink coffee, they drink wine, they spend money. And so we're finding more and more retailer support and popular bike lanes because they see what an economic impact and an economic driver cyclists are.
So sort of what you're saying is, in addition to bike shops and suppliers like our wholesalers, our manufacturers, you know, our apparel manufacturers, all of that, that you see the whole community around bicycle activity as being part of what you're trying to foster.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the better job we do of having business tell the story of the power of bicycling, the economic impact of bicycling, and the jobs that are created from it, I think the more powerful we'll be. And so our trick here is to capture that story and to really leverage it in different local communities.
I'm speaking with Jen Dice. She is the VP for Government Relations in the new Leslie Bohm Strategy Center at Bikes Belong, better known as the War Room. So money is always a factor when we talk about lobbying efforts. Are there going to be new campaigns to sort of build a war chest for these efforts?
Definitely. I think that has to be part of the equation. We have had a good bikes pack, but we haven't really made a concerted effort to grow that, and we'll be looking at different strategies to grow our political action committee. We'll also be looking at district events, you know, really getting involved in district funding and maybe some local and state packs. We've seen some really creative things that different local advocacy groups have done locally and statewide, and I think we're going to tap into that network and learn from some of their successes and see if we can copy that around the country.
You know, it used to be years and years ago, I said we needed some sort of a generic bicycle television campaign, you know, something like the Bike Council. Today, I guess we'd be looking more at social media. So is social media going to be something that you're looking at to begin to get the word out?
Well, it's been really exciting to see the People for Bikes campaign evolve. We actually, because this is Bike Month,
right,
and we just launched a public service announcement yesterday on peopleforbikes.org. We're up to about 750,000 people that have signed our pledge, you know, united behind one movement for better bicycling. And there's a number of PSAs that are going to be coming out of that campaign. Social media has been a huge component of it as well. And I think tapping into that younger millennial generation and the tech community is really a great opportunity for us. I think a lot of great things will happen if we leverage social media and sort of the tech community to help us tell the story.
I know that one of the things you want to do is to actually lobby and lobby at whatever level, whether it's city or state or county or even federal. We've lost several very key legislators, especially in the last election cycle, the Secretary of Transportation, who's been in our corner, is about to step down. Do you think that we can still depend upon federal help, you know, to further the goals of cycling? Do you think that? So I know we have our bike summit every year, and the agenda was very different this year than it's been in the past. They were told, of course, that we know you're out there. You know, just keep doing your work. So you don't have to get their attention anymore. But do you see that some things might change at the federal level? Because, you know, a lot of the money that needs to come for some infrastructure is going to have to come from the federal level, I would think.
You know, we definitely have our work cut out for us at the federal level. You know, we're really optimistic about the new secretary. He has been very friendly to cycling in North Carolina. You know, he's young, he's energetic. We're looking forward to getting to know him better. You know, there's been a number of members of Congress that have been very supportive. I'm trying to think of a few of them off the top of my head.
Well, Earl Blumenauer would be one, Jim Oberstar, because Oberstar is gone. But, yeah, Blumenauer is the big guy, yeah.
Exactly. Jack Kingston is a Republican from Georgia that's been really great. Senator Cardin, you know, Senator Carper, Congressman DeFazio from Oregon, La Tourette from Ohio. He's retiring, but he's been very supportive of cycling. But really, to answer your question, there is a lot of amazing things happening at the state and local level. We're seeing some of the most creative, dynamic campaigns coming from mayors, and a lot of cities are really doing great things for cycling. I think it was 5 years ago the first bike share opened, and now we have 42 bike shares across the country in 42 different cities, and there's about 20 more on deck. And we're seeing the most protected bike lanes and bicycle infrastructure going in cities. So a big part of our effort is going to be focusing in on already successful city campaigns and pushing them to a higher level.
Well, I think you have your work cut out for you.
I hope
yeah, you definitely will. No, I know. And you definitely have the energy for it. I can hear that. So let's just talk about the people who can get involved. Of course, you can still go out and sign the pledge on peopleforbikes.org is really where the pledge is. Yep. And you can still do other things. Do you think there are going to be other roles that open up for the average person as you begin to sort of develop your department?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the technology-driven solutions that we're looking at are going to make that more or easier and more interactive because we want to be extremely inclusive with our new People for Bikes campaigns. We just have a lot of creative partners that are coming out of the woodwork that want to be part of the network. You know, a good example is New Belgium in May is putting our People for Bikes logo on all their on their bottles of Fat Tire beer and Ranger IPA. And so millions of bottles of beer across the country are going to be promoting our movement.
That's awesome.
And funneling that money back into local campaigns for cycling. So it's an exciting time at People for Bikes because we're doing really dynamic new partnerships with local advocacy groups, with state advocacy groups, and really thinking about organizing the business voice behind it. So we're really reinventing everything here, and everything is changing because, as you commented, the traditional advocacy methods have only gotten us so far. And so our board has really directed us to shake things up, partner with different entities, be a little bit more creative and dynamic, and really try to move the needle for cycling. And so that's what the new emerging People for Bikes campaigns are all about.
Well, I am looking forward to seeing some new things open up for cycling on many levels. And I am so glad I got to catch up with you and learn about you and talk to you. So I will stay tuned, as we say here in the radio business, and I will look for what's going on at Bikes Belong. We talk to Tim Blumenthal every so often, but if I can get back to you every so often, I'd appreciate that too.
We would love it. We just so appreciate the opportunity, Diane, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Jen. Have a great evening.
You too. Take care.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Jen Dice joined me from her office at Bikes Belong in Boulder, Colorado. I think she's a pretty amazing woman, and I'm really anxious to see what she can accomplish in bringing some of the individual factions of bicycling together. I think maybe it's time that we're going to see some really new and exciting things happening for cycling in the U.S. We're going to have some news right now, and then we're going to take a break. I'm not sure whether to laugh or cry at this story. It's from the New York Times. Justice Breyer has shoulder surgery. It's from the Associated Press originally. It was published on April 27th. That Supreme Court Justice Stephen G. Breyer was in a Washington hospital after shoulder replacement surgery on Saturday following a bicycle accident. Justice Breyer, who's 74, was expected to make a full recovery after the operation, said a court spokeswoman, Kathy Arberg. His right shoulder was injured on Friday in a fall near the Korean War Veterans Memorial. Previously, the justice broke his collarbone in an accident in 2011 and sustained broken ribs and a punctured lung in a bicycle crash in 1993 before he joined the court. President Clinton appointed Justice Breyer to the court in 1994. So this is his third bike accident. I think it's three strikes and you're out, maybe. You know, at 74, you're falling down, you're getting hurt. A shoulder replacement is a big deal, I think. A really, really big deal. My next story is about inside the Cycleplex, the weird, wild world of Google Bikes. You might remember, I think we talked about this, this comes from Wired Magazine, that the people at Google all got bikes as a gift last year. So not far from Google's headquarters in Mountain View, California, there's a nondescript building that looks like it might be home to a stealth startup. But if you walk in the front door, you won't find cubicles or computers. You'll find a secret bike shop where people like Robert Jimenez and Terry Mack twist wrenches and true wheels all day long, rocking out to AC/DC and Pink Floyd. Then if you slip into the back room, you'll see them 1,300 green, blue, red, and yellow Google bikes stacked Santa's workshop style as far as the eye can see. This building is the nervous system for a remarkable campus-wide bike-sharing program that doubles as a mirror of the search giant's corporate culture. On any given day, you can find about 700 of the bikes scattered like toys across Google's Mountain View campus. All morning long, Google's private shuttle buses drop off employees in front of clumps of bikes. The Googlers mount up and ride to work. Jimenez and Mac are part of a seven-person army that keeps them up and running 7 days a week. Apple has campus bikes, as do Facebook, LinkedIn, and others. But there's nothing quite like Google's. quote, Google is certainly unique in their commitment to bicycling, unquote, says Colin Haney, deputy director of the Silicon Valley Bicycle Coalition. More than 7% of Googlers bike into work each day at the company's main campus. There, Google has on-site showers with lockers and a towel service, security parking areas, complete with repair tools, and on-site bike repair service and bike-friendly shuttle buses for employees who want to bike just the last few miles of their commute. So I think that's kind of interesting that Google did all that. This comes from The Economist. Cycling is the new golf. This makes me happy. April 26th. Traditionally, business associates would get to know each other over a round of golf, but road cycling is fast catching up as the preferred way of networking for the modern professional. A growing number of corporate-sponsored charity bike rides and city cycle clubs are providing an ideal opportunity to talk shop with like-minded colleagues and clients while discussing different bike frames and tricky headwinds. Many believe cycling is better than golf for building lasting working relationships or landing a new job because it is less competitive. Really? Than golf? Okay. Quote, when you play golf with somebody, you have to decide if you're going to beat them or let them beat you, says Peter Murray, a former architect, journalist, and chairman of the NLA Center dedicated to London's built environment. If they're a client and you don't want to beat them, you have to sort of cheat in order to lose. That seems to me not a good way of doing things. Well, so my question is, since when is cycling not as competitive as golf? So I'm not sure if this really holds water in my mind. I don't know. We'll see. I think it's funny. This is from the Business Insider. 13 reasons you should start biking to work. So, you know, this could be one of those like David Letterman top 10s, I guess. Though the U.S. has seen a 40% growth in bicycle commuters since 2000, their numbers have yet to surpass 1 million. In contrast, there are 204 million personal vehicles on the road on any given day, and that's a shame. Not only does biking to work have the potential to improve individuals' health, wealth, and standard of living, but the combination of more cyclists and fewer cars on the road could give the entire country a much-needed boost. It would make cycling safer for everyone. It is vastly cheaper than driving. It's a free gym on wheels. On average, a person will lose 13 pounds the first year of cycling. Cycling could help get you there faster for a lot less. Half of the working population in the U.S. commute 5 miles or less to work, with bike trips of 3 to 5 miles taking less time or the same amount of time as commuting by car, writes Kiplinger editor Amanda Lilly. You don't even have to own a bike. There's been a wave of new bike share programs in major cities like Washington, Boston, Chicago, and Miami, which typically allow riders 30 to 45 minutes of free transportation for a small annual fee. When New York City's bike share launches in May this month, annual memberships will cost $95, about $10 less than what subway commuters spend per month. And we could save hundreds of millions on healthcare and expenses. So that's my news. And we are going to take a break, and I will be right back, and we're going to have a nice conversation about e-bikes for those people who don't necessarily ride a bike right now and want a bike, or you want a little boost. We'll talk with Larry Peasy from Curry Technologies. I'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
What do your status updates say? You're learning a new language? Going all organic? Instead of typing your feelings, what if you could put them into action? By creating a network to help keep kids off the streets? In a country like Armenia? Or in Honduras? What if every ounce of your being helped update the status of a person? And in turn, they did the same for you? Would this be enough social interaction? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. Get interactive at peacecorps.gov/game.
I'm Diane Lees, and we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to head on out to Simi Valley, California, and talk with the president of Curry Technologies, Larry Peasy. Larry, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks so much for joining me.
Sure, Diane. Thanks very much for having me back.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I wanted to talk with you because I've had several listeners ask for an extended discussion on e-bikes, and I think you're the man.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the category is growing pretty rapidly, and there is a lot of excitement about it.
Well, let's start with the definition of an e-bike, just so that everybody's sort of on a level playing field here.
Sure. Well, in 2002, there was a federal law that was made public that defines a low-speed electric bike as a two- or three-wheeled vehicle with fully operable pedals and an electric motor of less than 750 watts, which is 1 horsepower,
okay,
with a maximum speed on, you know, paved level surfaces with a 170-pound rider aboard that's less than 20 miles an hour. And in essence, that's the definition that the industry attempts to follow in, you know, in designing products for this category. That the interesting thing is that and the relevance of this federal law and definition is that these were determined to be bicycles and not motor vehicles under this code, and this is it was amended, the bicycle code that is regulated by the Consumer Product Safety Commission as opposed to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
So, interesting.
Or Department of Transportation.
So years and years and years ago, and I mean years ago, there was sort of a little motor that you could mount, I think, to the back of the bicycle, and it would give you a boost and give you a boost. But things have really changed, and the category's growing. There is a more of a consumer demand for the product. Who is your target customer for an e-bike?
Well, that's a great question, and I think what has happened over time is that as the product has gotten more and more compelling, and that the designs have become more, you know, purpose-built, and all the electronics integrated into the design of the bike, the customer has changed a bit. 10 or 11 years ago, when I first started at Curry Technologies, I would say that the target customer was the aging baby boomer that had some sort of a health issue that really prohibited them from riding a normal bike. But now, while that's still a portion of the customer base, it's really defined by two categories. One is sort of aging boomers that are just looking to stay outdoor and active. They don't necessarily have, you know, health problems. Some of them might. Some of them, their bodies may have broken down a little bit, you know, knees and hips and things like that did start to deteriorate after a while, and they need a little help. But the interesting thing that's happened is that, and this is not a demographic, it's more of a psychographic, people that live in crowded urban areas that are looking for transportation alternatives are probably the fastest growing segment of the market. And it's a very, very wide range of ages. It can be younger people that, you know, don't own a car or not interested in a car for local trips, or, you know, older people as well and everybody in between.
If we were to take this e-bike, can it be used besides on the road? Can it be used on bike paths and in, you know, protected bike lanes?
Well, that's a great question, and that question, unfortunately, is not an easy one to answer, because it is up to the state and sometimes even the local government to decide what the use restrictions might be for an e-bike. And it seems to be unfolding like this. The more prevalent e-bikes are, the more local governments are really having to deal with the question of where these things can be used. It's interesting that the major advocacy groups like the League of American Bicyclists and Bikes Belong Coalition and Rails to Trails Conservancy are very supportive of e-bikes and shared use of bicycle infrastructure. But initially, it's sort of counterintuitive to, local regulators to say, okay, this is a bike and it's got a motor on it, and it says on the sign that we put up, no motor vehicles allowed
right. On
this infrastructure, and they have a hard time sort of wrapping their heads around it. So, you know, it sort of brings us back to the federal definition that says this low-speed electric bike, by definition, is not a motor vehicle, but is actually to be considered a bicycle. And once this goes full circle, I believe what will happen is that these low-speed electric bicycles will be allowed on basic bicycle infrastructure. In principle, you know, they're a little bit heavier. The average weight is probably somewhere around 55 pounds, which is heavy in contrast to a normal bicycle. But with a top speed of 20 miles an hour, it is not such a departure from what a normal bike will do. And, I think that it's been my experience anyway, that once people, you know, learn how to ride them correctly and they sort of are observant of the, kind of environment they find themselves in and, aren't terrorizing the road, or the bikeway, that they fit in really nicely on, standard bicycle infrastructure and should really be included.
Well, let's talk a moment about how to ride one of these bikes. So they're actually electric assist, right?
Yeah.
You can still pedal it if you want.
Oh, absolutely. And,
okay.
And, the better bikes that are on the market today are really designed to be ridden just like a normal bike. And in pedal assist mode, they have a very, very smooth transition of assisted motor power. So, in essence, it's like getting a little boost, having sort of a perpetual tailwind, and
nice.
has the ability, yeah, absolutely, has the ability to sort of level the hills, which, a lot of people really struggle with. And in many instances, it prevents them from even considering riding a bike because, it can be such an arduous experience climbing.
Right,
So, they're designed to be ridden like a normal bike, and they're constructed like a normal bike. Their geometries are such that, anatomically you get on it and you want to pedal. So it's really a perfect human hybrid.
Well, and that was going to be my next point, that you'll get into something like a Prius hybrid, come to a stop, and it sounds like your car died. And
right.
Then, it takes over and starts up again. So I can understand how it would be preferable for some people to ride an e-bike as opposed to a regular pedal bike all the time. I want to also talk about the environmental impact of an e-bike. Why is it positive for the environment to buy and use an electric assist bike as opposed to anything else?
Well, if it's an alternative to some other form of motorized transportation, obviously it has numerous positive environmental benefits. Certainly in contrast to a fossil fuel burning car, it's huge. It's not as good as a normal bicycle, of course, or walking, but it's probably third on the list from an environmental perspective. It
okay.
has very, very low impact. And, it takes minimal amounts of energy to recharge a battery pack that, will take you, 20 to 40 miles on a single charge. It's pennies worth of electricity to recharge the battery pack. And, of course, you can make ions on your roof with
right.
a solar panel or, a wind turbine. So it is a very environmentally friendly vehicle, but when compared to other forms of motorized transportation or even public transportation for that matter.
Well, plus it's healthier to ride than it is to ride in a vehicle that you have no energy, that you're not putting any energy into.
Exactly. And, there are some interesting studies that have happened. There's certainly situational things that we find out about all the time from letters that we get from our customers about how, an e-bike has changed their life and has got them fit and they've lost weight, and you know how it sort of eased them in to cycling, which is really, you know, we love to hear this stuff. There are some studies being done at universities today where they're really analyzing the health benefits of people riding e-bikes, and they're really numerous. It sounds a little strange, especially to people that are, you know, that are already cyclists and they have a level of fitness that makes them feel as though anybody can do this. But in reality, if you look at, you know, most people in our society, they can't ride a bike for more than a couple of miles without really, you know, tasking themselves. But once they get on an e-bike, it eases them back in and gives them the confidence to get out on the bike. Well, then, of course, their fitness level continually improves.
Let me take a moment and remind you, we are speaking with Larry Pesey. He is the president of Curry Technologies. They are pretty much one of the leaders in e-bike, electric assist bikes. Tell me about e-bikes and bike sharing programs. So many cities are now getting into bike sharing, like D.C., and now New York is coming online, and of course places like Portland and Minneapolis. Are e-bikes a category within the bike sharing programs yet?
Well, not in the United States today. Today we have some pilot programs and we have some test programs going on. The most established one is called Cycle You Share at the University of Tennessee. And for about 2.5, almost 3 years now, we've had some of our bikes in a program at UT, which is a very, sort of hilly terrain. The campus is not at all flat, so it's challenging for students and staff to get around that campus on normal bikes. So it was really the perfect environment to do this test. And it's doing extremely well. But here's the downside. Electric bicycles, primarily due to, components like a high-capacity lithium-ion battery pack, which is a pretty costly component,
right,
are four or five times more expensive than a normal bike. And the economies of scale when it comes to bike share programs is pretty challenging today just with normal bikes, you know, making it pay off, making it either revenue neutral or, you know, actually, you know, benefiting from a profitability perspective to the operators of these share programs. So, I think that they will become a part of bike share as time goes on. And, I think that societies have to get used to bike share in general. And, you know, clearly we see that happening in a big way in major cities across, even smaller cities across the United States and in Europe and Canada. As these programs become more popular, I'm confident that e-bikes will be part of them.
So let's talk a little bit about the pricing of the bikes, because bicycles today aren't inexpensive. You can go walk into a bike shop and find a high-end bike in the $10,000 to $12,000 category, and e-bikes aren't like that. And yet the person who buys a low-end, and when I say low-end, you know, sort of commuter transportation bike, is probably expecting to spend between maybe $300 and $500 or $600. What is the price range for an e-bike? What does that add to the price of, say, a commuter bike?
Sure. Well, that's also a great question, Diane. They range in price from about $1,000, and they go up to, you know, as much as $6,000. Specialized just introduced a new bike that is a $6,000 bike. It's a fast urban, you know, e-bike.
Right.
The price points based on the level of components and the complexity and the frame and the technology involved can, you know, drive the price up pretty significantly. But our average retail selling price in 2012 was about $2,200. What we find is that a lot of people come in And, you know, they have this perception that, you know, okay, maybe around $500 is a reasonable price for a normal bicycle. And they're generally willing to pay a premium for an e-bike. They understand that they're going to cost more. And their expectation is that they can get a bike for maybe twice the price of a normal bike. And, you know, of course, there are products. We do have products that started at around $1,000. So they get on it, and then they try, you know, two or three different models. You know, these are as function specific as normal bikes. They're, you know, different models for different intents. And then they'll land on something that they, you know, they like the general feel and the ride and the comfort, you know, for their particular intent. And normally they wind up spending, you know, more than $2,000 on one.
Interesting. Very interesting. Who is making the componentry for these bikes? These are not necessarily, or are they, Shimano or SRAM or Equip bikes?
Well, that's also a great question. All of the major bicycle component manufacturers, to some extent, are getting involved in building e-bike components. It may not be the electronic components,
right?
But they might be, you know, the normal components, but they're making them appropriate for e-bikes so that they can have, you know, appropriate braking and brake inhibit switches built in to, you know, cut off the motor power when somebody brakes or to turn it into a regenerative braking mode. But there are a number of companies that have emerged that are specializing in the e-bike components, the electronic components. You know, we make some proprietary components on some of our products using third-party vendors that have produced them for us in Taiwan and China. But companies like Bosch, you know, the major consumer electronics company that also supplies the automobile industry,
right,
has rapidly become one of the leaders in the space in Western Europe. And in 2014, we're going to introduce some Bosch Drive-equipped bikes into the U.S. marketplace, which is quite exciting. Their technology is a little bit different, works really well for certain types of bicycles, and, you know, I think just gives you an indication at how serious a company like Bosch, who, you know, is larger than the entire bicycle industry combined, is interested in this category. They see, you know, out into the future that two-wheel electric mobility is going to be a very, very significant component in this changing mobility paradigm.
One of the things we didn't really talk about was the range of the electric bike. I think you alluded to it, but I'm not sure we actually got into it. So I get on my electric bike. It's charged up in the morning. What is the distance before I need to recharge that battery again?
Well,
average.
Again, a really good question, and it does vary depending on the model and what the
sure.
model is designed to do. But on average, I would say the minimum range is about 20 miles, and the maximum range, you know, can be more than 40. You know, I have a particular model that I've ridden at a relatively low assist level. And I've ridden for close to 60 miles on a single battery charge. So it can range pretty dramatically.
Yes.
20 being the minimum. And, you know, what we find is that, especially when bikes are considered, you know, part of a transportation alternative, that 20 miles is more than most people are going to travel.
Yeah, most people aren't going to take this on a century ride.
Exactly.
So the last thing I really would like to talk about is how the demand for the e-bikes is in Europe compared to the U.S. and how sales are actually growing. I think e-bikes are already accepted more readily in Europe. Is that true? Or in Europe and Asia?
Well, that's exactly true. And the reason, in my opinion, that the market is more mature, it's actually they've become mainstream products in certain European countries, is primarily because Europeans, since, you know, the middle 70s, have really considered a normal bicycle as a transportation device. And they've got great infrastructure for cycling, you know, bike paths and cycle track and, you know, separated areas, protected bike lanes. So people feel very safe in crowded urban areas using a bike for transportation. So an e-bike just, really just gets more people on bicycles, people that are aging out or people that can't afford to show up, to their work perspired. It's a perfect solution. In the U.S., of course, we're making some great progress, especially in the last, 5 or 7 years with bike infrastructure. We're way behind. But as we build out great infrastructure, of course, in, some of the most bike-friendly cities in the United States, we're seeing a huge increase, a real spike in use as bicycles for transportation. Those same cities happen to be our strongest markets.
Which is quite interesting. So what kind of difference do you see from 2012? What are you projecting in 2013 as a sales increase in terms of whatever you want to call it, numbers or units?
Well, we project pretty conservatively. And what we've seen really since 2008, when gas started to get expensive and people started really trying to rationalize, their mobility spend, we've seen between a 15 and 20% increase in the sales each year
wow.
over year, which is pretty considerable. Now, it's a small category. It's still a small category today. We're just beginning to show up on the radar of, the bike industry in the United States tracking those sales. But as time goes on, I think we're going to reach a tipping point just like it happened in Western Europe, where bike shops have come to the realization that this is a category that's going to be around for a long time. It's not going away. Product keeps getting better, more reliable, more compelling to the user. And once the bike shops start stocking the product and supporting the product, I think it will drive, a tipping point, and it will become mainstream here in the United States. We'll have pretty much the same, dynamics as we see in Western Europe, where about, 1 in 7 bicycles that are sold are electric.
Wow, that's a big number.
It's a huge number.
Yeah, it's a huge number. So when I go to Interbike this year and I'm looking around the floor, how many manufacturers are going to actually be showing an e-bike besides Curry? And Specialized, well, evidently.
Yeah, I think that you'll see as time goes on that pretty much every major brand of bicycles is going to have an e-bike component to
Interesting.
It.
Interesting.
Companies are getting into the category because they see the success of the category in Western Europe. And they see how it can really be beneficial to society of, getting people to think about getting on two wheels as opposed to getting in four wheels for, neighborhood errands and, short distance commutes and things of that nature.
So the last thing I want to ask you is about supporting bicycle efforts from the e-bike category. Bikes Belong, for example, is supported by Trek, especially, and some of the other big manufacturers. And then we have People for Bikes, and we have LAB. Are Curry and some of the other electric bike manufacturers getting involved in that sort of group effort to move cycling in general along?
Well, yes. We do, and we are very active. Now, we're very fortunate that, we're part of a much larger company. We're an Excel Group company. Excel is actually one of the largest bicycle companies in Western Europe and the largest electric bicycle company in Europe. We have many, many brands that you may or may not know, about 50 brands in our portfolio. In North America, Excel owns a company called Seattle Bike Supply and Raleigh and Curry Technologies. So we have the benefit of a larger group of companies. And together, Excel Group supports bikes belong in a significant way. And, you know, we believe that advocacy, you know, is foundational because infrastructure is, you know, is the first objection that people have. When there are safe places to ride bicycles, we're going to sell more bicycles because more people are going to participate. So it's, you know, it's foundational for us, and we're very supportive of the advocacy efforts of, you know, all these organizations. And we do everything that we can, you know, to help spread the word with regard to, you know, supporting these groups so we can get our fair share of the, you know, transportation budgets to, you know, to build out better places to ride. You know, other companies in the space, well, you know, there's a lot of e-bike only companies that you know, are relatively young and getting started. You know, I think that as the category continues to scale, they will also join in supporting bicycle advocacy in general.
What is the breakdown between men and women riding e-bikes? Do you know that? Do you have some sort of a number?
We do have a number, and you know, it's interesting. It does vary by, you know, by demographics. We're finding that in, you know, the boomer demographic, that it's slightly more men than women are riding.
Okay.
But interestingly, in the younger demographic, it's about 70% women.
Wow.
So, you know, we're seeing a very significant number of women urban dwellers. A lot of them are moms that are, you know, this is like an alternative to getting in their car. You know, they can carry their child or children on a, you know, on a bike seat or in a trailer, and go grocery shopping, and, you know, it's just a very convenient way for people to get around. You know, in crowded urban areas, you know, parking is a big issue, and certainly the cost of, you know, owning that second car can be really prohibitive. So it's offering a great alternative to, you know, that particular demographic.
Well, I think we are going to end on that particular note. Go, girls. I'm into that. And I really appreciate you taking all this time to talk with me about the e-bike category. I think it's very important. We've been asked by listeners to talk about it. And Larry Peasy, president of Curry Technologies, they make the iZip bikes and the eZip scooters, right?
Correct.
And it's good to talk to you again, Larry. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Have a great day.
You too.
All righty. Bye-bye. Larry Peasy joined me from his office in Simi Valley, California at Curry Technologies, and I enjoyed my conversation about e-bikes. Very knowledgeable guy, has been in the business a long time. He and I were retailers together. He was in Philadelphia, I was in Cleveland, and he got into the e-bike business, I think, at a good time. So that's our show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it. Jen Dice and Larry Peasy, I thank them again for being on the show with me. And I promise we are going to have the Secretary of Transportation next week. So go out and have a bike ride. Thank you so much, and we'll see you again. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.